When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello, welcome to our podcast, The Signal
and the Noise,
that will attempt to give you a peek into the inner workings of Mint's long story. This is Sunit.
And I am Ajay.
And we are both editors with Mint.
Every week, either one of us will attempt to walk you through the most defining development in the world of business, politics, or technology.
Let's dive in.
Hi, this is Sunit, and my guest today knows Mumbai like the back of her hand. Smruti Kopikar is a journalist who has covered some key stories about Bombay. The riots, bomb blasts, terror attacks, the underworld, among others. She's an expert on the city and urban spaces, and has also written chapters for books on the city. Smruti has worked for many years in Outlook, where our paths intersected. Currently, she teaches journalism and designs media courses at top colleges. I'm speaking to Smruti at a time Maharashtra is rocked by a political scandal about its extortion economy, which Smruti captured in a brilliant long story last week. I ask her about extortion and its link to politics, the police, the underworld, and Bollywood. Listen in for a fascinating conversation.
Hi, Smruti. Welcome to The Signal and the Noise.
Hi, Sunit. Very happy to be on the show.
So, Smruti, extortion and politics is the talk of town right now, and Maharashtra government's future hangs in the balance, so to speak. When we spoke before your long story and when we were discussing it, you had asked, hasn't extortion been happening before? And why is it only seen as a Mumbai problem? And that's because it has to do with politics, right?
Yes and no. Extortion, I think, wherever it happens, it used to be an urban phenomenon, but it's also now not an urban phenomenon. But wherever it happens, it's linked with politics. But Mumbai has, in my view, Mumbai has two or three additional factors for this to become national headlines and also become a little glamorous. So to the mix of extortion and politics, Mumbai ends up adding the underworld when it existed, and it does, it still does in some form. It also adds the Bollywood. And then it also adds this very vibrant street economy that just never goes to sleep, right? So when you combine all of that, then the mix becomes really potent. It also acquires a very edgy character, much like one of these OTT series. And also there is that element where I think the whole trend kind of began in 70s, where Bollywood turned extortion into a story, into a major story, and built characters around it and gave them some sort of sinister, malevolent kind of characteristics. And that kind of caught on. So I think in the popular imagination, extortion tends to be a very Mumbai thing or a very Bombay thing, but in reality, I'm sure all of us acknowledge that it's not only this city, but probably across the country in many ways.
Right. And obviously, the politics is why we are getting into the story now. So can you quickly run us through the controversy that has been playing out over the last month or so?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the whole story begins with an SUV that was found parked outside a few meters, a few hundred meters away from Antilia, which is Mukesh Ambani's residential tower, on Altamount Road or the Carmichael Road, which is really called the billionaire's borough in India. And that vehicle had 20 gelatin sticks. and a note which was a threat to the Ambanis. The unraveling of that led to Assistant Police Inspector Sachin Vaze of the Mumbai Police, whose footprint or fingerprints were over all of that conspiracy, which then subsequently led to the very unceremonious transfer of the Mumbai Police Commissioner, very justly too, because Vaze was apparently dealing directly with the commissioner, bypassing almost six levels of hierarchy, was using all kinds of fancy vehicles, including Mercedes and BMWs and things like that, parked in the commissioner's compound. And that's a very large complex, but these cars used to be parked there. And that then, once the commissioner was asked to vacate his post, he thought it was opportune at that moment to point fingers to the state home minister, who is Mr. Anil Deshmukh of the Nationalist Congress Party, and level an allegation that the home minister of Maharashtra had given targets of 100 crore a month to be collected as extortion amounts from bars and hotels and things like that. Which, of course, then, unraveled completely and became a political controversy, a political thriller, if you would have it, because the BJP, it's a very active opposition in Maharashtra, and that's an understatement. So the BJP really ran with the story, went to Delhi, made headlines, asked for CBI inquiry and all of that. And now somehow the whole thing has come to be stuck as Chief Minister Uddhav Thackeray and 100 crore a month extortion amount. Now, for those of us who've covered the city and covered the Shiv Sena for the last 25, 30 years, as I have, we know that the Shiv Sena's story interweaves with the extortion story in many ways. But outside of Maharashtra and outside of Bombay, the chief minister is now beginning to be seen as this presiding over this 100 crore a month kind of extortion thing. For anyone who's been here, Sunit, and I'm sure you'd also attest to this, 100 crore a month is literally peanuts. The extortion economy, as we've spoken, literally runs into thousands of crores. And just to put a figure on this, the figure of 6,000 crores was quoted in the Bombay High Court last week when the former commissioner's petition came up for admission.
6,000 crores per annum?
They didn't specify, but the talk was 100 crores a month. And the lawyer for one of the petitioners said, no, it's not that, it's 6,000 crores. So I hope it is per annum and not per month, because then that would beat many sectors of the legitimate economy hollow completely.
Right. Okay, so let's step back a little bit and from the political controversy and move to the role of the police, because it's clear that this is a key factor in the story where the police are a part and parcel of the extortion process. And that's a truism, right?
Yes, very much, very much. The police force tends to be one of the most visible faces of any administration, anywhere, really. So it is here. And simply by virtue of being that, individual cops, as much as the entire system, the edifice, is in a position to crack down on individuals, on businesses, on large corporations, literally for some violation or the other. And they enjoy, therefore, official authority and also what I call unofficial clout in a way that they are able to mix and merge the two to extract what they want and what their masters want or what their political masters want from the average citizen or from our regular mom and pop shops or businesses or even large corporations, really. But they are not the only channel. This channel perhaps runs across several other services, like the revenue offices, right down the hierarchy from the state government downwards, the forest department. But I must say that my observation over the years is that the home department, which obviously controls or regulates the police force, the home department and the revenue department tend to be the most coveted departments for any party in any government. And I should think that the link really is quite clear why people would really fall head over heels to be in charge of these two departments rather than, say, agriculture or industry or something else. So I'm sure there are many other channels as well, but the police are a very, very visible, important channel. And I think, like the former Mumbai Police Commissioner M.N. Singh told us, there are party people on the ground of several political parties who often double up as extortionists. And there are extortionists in uniform as well. And that, I think he was putting it a little mildly, but that's the truth.
You also make the point that the extortion economy has not suffered over the past 30 years or so, under numerous governments and notably under the BJP-led government, which is leveling allegations right now, the previous BJP-led government. So it is politics neutral in that sense.
Yes, it's politics neutral, it's politics agnostic. It's one of those parts of urban economy that continue irrespective of who's in power. And it's not only not suffered, Suni, it's mutated, it's transformed, and it's expanded over the last few years. And, you know, just to give you an example, it's not this government, it's not the government before this or the government before that or whatever. Just the previous government that was headed by the BJP, where the Sena was also a coalition partner in that government, but it was visibly a BJP government. So during that government's tenure, fingers were pointed to a very, very senior IPS officer, not once, but three different times. By three different people, including a person in the police force, in the middle rung. The other two were from gangsters who were caught and were in jail. And they all attested to the fact that this very senior IPS officer literally ran an extortion racket from his positions. And one of the gangsters named him as the boss, quote unquote, the boss. I'm sure Mr. Fundis knew about it. He should have known. He would have known about it. He was not only the chief minister, he was also the home minister of Maharashtra. He did not really take any action. He did not, you know, transfer or ask anyone to look at this closely or deeply. And we must therefore ask the question, why? Did he know? If he didn't know, why didn't he know? That was his department. But from what information one has, it seems that he knew. If he knew, why did he keep quiet? Why was he protecting? Was he protecting this IPS cop? And if so, why? And the answer really to that is that all political parties look for lots of money to contest elections and spend during the election, well beyond what the Election Commission of India allows them to. And a good portion of this does come from the extortion economy. And it's not just money, it's also quid pro quos, you know. Like you give us 100 cars during the election, you print banners for us and we'll let this case go off record, you know, things like that. So there are lots of different kinds of quid pro quos. Money is one of them, but it's really impossible to believe at this stage that the extortion story began in November 2019 when Uddhav Thackeray became the chief minister. The slate was squeaky clean when Mr. Fadnavis was heading the government for 5 years. It's simply not true, though that's the perception that's being created.
I think much of the focus has been on bars and restaurants. But give us an example of how it would work for a citizen, say, Say, for example, what if I decide to chuck it all and buy a house in Lonavala? I'll get a call, right?
Well, you could. You could, especially if you went to Lonavala all the time in a slightly fancy car, had a particular number plate that indicated that you came from Mumbai or particularly from South Bombay, and bought a place worth a couple of crores or more in Lonavala, then it's quite evident that you are in a position to pay. And the extortion economy is really vibrant and throbbing outside Bombay, outside Mumbai these days. And Lonavala and Talapad, and these are all places that have seen recent cases of especially targeting people who've come from outside, the quote-unquote non-locals. And we have one couple actually speak to us in that story. We couldn't identify them, unfortunately, but they did. And they received a very indirect call saying, oh, you know, we are your neighbors and you must now donate to this fabulous town that you are now going to reside in. And the person had a very clear, direct connection to the local politician there. So,
and what would happen if I go to the police?
And this is where the interesting part comes, and this is where the intersection comes, right? If you go to the police, then the police are likely to tell you, do you want to register a case? Because if you register a case, you're going to be made to run around from the district magistrate upwards. It won't come up for hearing. You know, you'll end up sleeping over this case, hanging over your head for God knows how many months. You've come here for a good, quiet life. Why do you want to bother with it? Why don't you just settle with this person? We'll make sure that he doesn't come and bother you again. And if you are inclined to do that, you would accept that some of that settlement amount might just go to the cop as well. So this is a trend that people have seen happen over and over again with in some small towns in Mumbai, outside Mumbai, in the larger Mumbai metropolitan region. And a lot of this has to do with land deals.
Right.
The threats, the extortion demands, the extortion attempts, they have to do with land. And land, as you know, Sunit, in Mumbai is the most scarce commodity. Families have split over land and people have been killed over land and property. And extortion, of course, uses that as a huge leverage.
And they have, stepping away from the specific example, could you give listeners a brief history of the extortion economy from Hafta and Vasooli, and who were the players of yore?
Yes, my reading tells me that this is not a recent phenomenon. It's changed over the decades, but it's not. There used to be some amount of unaccounted for wealth, even in British Bombay, and some of it came to be parked in real estate even then. A little bit of it went into cinema as well, and that's one of the reasons that cinema took root in Bombay rather than in any other city, because there was money to roil it, so to speak. But the more recent history, I think, would go back to the post-60s, 70s, and is very deeply tied with smuggling, because India was such a highly controlled economy. So smuggling of everything, smuggling of FMCG, finest scotch, and then, of course, the bootlegging. And bootlegging was a huge source of revenue for those who made money off it. And one of the first was, of course, Abdul Latif, who was based in Ahmedabad but used the Bombay route. Then there was Varadrajan Mudaliar, on whom films have been made, including Dayawan and films like that. Then this is about the 70s. Then we have Haji Mastan, Karim Lala, Yusuf Pathan, those gangs. They have again been kind of immortalized in Bollywood. as wearing these all white attire with a patch on their eye and things like that. Though in real life, I've met two of them and they were not really like that at all. They were pretty, when I met them, they came across as very kind old gentlemen, which evidently they weren't. Then, of course, you have the 80s when the gangsterism and gang wars both surged across Bombay. You had famously the Daud Ibrahim gang, and then in 1993, Chota Rajan broke away from him. Then you have the smaller local gangs like the Arun Gavli and Ashwin Nayak gangs, who were really Marathi and who had no compunction extorting money from their fellow Marathi brethren in central Bombay, in the mill area, and made their gangs work. So it's only after the Maharashtra Control of Organized Crime Act was enacted in 1999 that you find that the gangsterism is on the wane, but it did not really touch the extortion economy. So you don't find that, you don't find the link between extortion and gangsters in 2020, 2021 as deeply, as symbiotically as it was in the 80s and 90s, but it continues to exist. So gangs continue to exist, gangsters are around, but most of the gangs, their spines have really been broken or bent by now. So we don't hear that much about gangsterism, but that doesn't mean they don't indulge in extortion, because Ejaz Lakdawala allegedly calls people from the jail that he is lodged in and makes demands of 5 crore and 15 lakh and 10 lakh and all kinds of demands. He demanded for flats from a builder and so on and so forth. So, as I said, the story has mutated. The way extortion runs has mutated. It's not only through gangs and gangsterism now. It's through many other channels. But the gangs do exist.
Yes, you also mentioned Bollywood as a inspiration to capture the gangsters and the gangs. But in the public perception, Bollywood also is a victim of extortion. Has that waned?
No, not really, because the filmmaker and actor Mahesh Manjrekar, in fact, registered a police complaint, in August or September of last year, just after the first lockdown, and said that he'd received a call, and ostensibly the caller said he's from the Abu Salem gang and he wanted so many crores. So the yes and no to answer your question. Bollywood personalities are victims of extortion demands, and these extortion calls and these extortion demands are actually highlighted in the media, and because they involve the Bollywood, they grab national headlines. So the perception is that the Bollywood is a victim of extortion, but it's also a theater in which the extortion economy plays out. At no point other than the 90s, and for a good, possibly for a good decade and a half, there was clearly a number of films that were financed with money that wasn't completely clean, whose sources could not be traced. Filmmakers then had come on record to say that they'd received calls saying, you have to take so-and-so actor, you have to take this actress in your film, you have to release your film on so-and-so date, you have to take this person as your music director. So, you know, those, and that's because the films had some sort of an underworld footprint. There's no getting away from it. So Bollywood does multiple things, in my opinion. A, it is a victim. Some people in Bollywood are victims of extortion. Some of them settle, some of them stand up. Some have paid with their lives. Some have become victims of cross-gangsterism. as that very famous case you would remember of Gulshan Kumar of T-Series. B, Bollywood also rides, a section of Bollywood is quite content to ride on money which isn't completely clean or which has underworld's fingerprints here and there. And C, Bollywood then goes on to create stories and tell stories, exaggerate both of these things, and often turn some of the gang bosses into some sort of anti-heroes, and, you know, actually build stories around them. And there is an edginess and there's a sense of drama and all that which captures the public imagination. So, so Bollywood is all of this at all together, actually, simultaneously.
That is absolutely fascinating and in many ways unchanging. How in this age of computers and internet and phones, how is the extortion economy adapted?
I'm told that cyber extortion is quite the thing now, particularly after the lockdown where so much of our life went online. So many more transactions went online. Surfing of the internet was one of the key things that we did through the year. And cyber extortion is really your data being tracked, extracted, sold to extortionists, and extortionists then getting back to you to say that I know which pawn sites you visited. I know what communication you had with XYZ, so on and so forth. And then literally using that to blackmail you to get what they want. And those demands, I'm told, have gone into crores already with some small industries and some commercial organizations. Individuals have received demands for 10, 15 lakhs saying, we know you visited so-and-so pawn site and we'll let your wife know that. And that's as blatant as it gets. And cyber extortion has become a thing, which is why the government rolled out a plan to have dedicated cyber police stations across Mumbai. They've inaugurated them, but I'm not sure that they're up and running yet.
Okay. And all this is via cash, right? So demonetization has had no impact whatsoever.
Oh, yes. A large part of it is through cash. Demonetization hasn't really helped. If anything, the 2,000 rupee note made it easier to cart money. And if you remember the whole Sachin Vazey story in the car that, in one of the cars that the NIA impounded, he had currency counting machine stashed at the back. Now, this was a cop car. What was a currency counting machine doing in the boot of the car? You know, so currency is the biggest, but there are others, and there are quid pro quos that happen saying, oh, you can do this for us and you can speak to that one for us. You can get this person to join our party. You know, there are those kinds of extortions also that happen and they're equally fascinating. But yes, what keeps this economy going is really the cash. That is it. And it, and one of the top cops who spoke to us for that story, explained this very beautifully. DGP Sanjay Pandey, and he said, you know, there is extortion that happens on the street with individuals when you break a traffic signal or you've parked where you shouldn't park or from roadside shops because somebody has come and set up his Bhelpuri stall where he shouldn't be. And there is that kind of hafta that happens, and hafta is a regular thing and people pay and just don't think about it. And we think this is extortion, but this is a very tiny, small part of the extortion economy. The larger part of the extortion economy, he says, is the more very structured, institutionalized part, which includes the police, the other channels, other kinds of offices and officials, and includes politicians, possibly the underworld, and it has a hierarchy and it goes right up to the top and everybody has a share in it. So, for example, if you set up an industry and you get an extortion amount for 10 lakh, it doesn't mean that, that 10 lakh goes only to the extortionist who got in touch with you. That 10 lakh portion of the 10 lakh probably reaches right at the top of the political and the police hierarchy in that region. So everybody tends to be invested in this in some way. And therefore, the motivation to completely eliminate it is simply not there. Which is why my observation is that if there is a very strong, committed, upright kind of a police commissioner, for example, he is able to keep it down. He is able to limit it. He is able to put his foot down and say this much and not more and not allow it to get out of hand. But other kinds of commissioners just are quite content, I suppose, to let things be the way they are. So commissioners can come and go, politicians can come and go, governments can come and go, but this pipeline continues, right? And this pipeline goes, the institutionalized extortion, this is a pipeline that goes on and on and on, irrespective of individuals. And right. To break so, back would really require a huge, huge reset. And a person who is really not invested in that, and that's really difficult to come by, because which politician isn't invested in it? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question.
Yeah. So what's the future of the Uddhav Thackeray government?
I think there will be chaos for some time. There will be a kind of uncertainty for a while, for the next month or so. And I think the BJP is going to make a fresh attempt after the results on May 2nd, depending on what happens to it in other parts, including and particularly in Bengal. What is amazing is that Mr. Sharad Pawar of the Nationalist Congress Party has kept a channel open with the BJP. He is really the remote control behind the Uddhav Thackeray government. And it's a huge piece of irony for people like us, because Mr. Thackeray's father, the late Bal Thackeray, was called the remote control behind the Shiv Sena BJP government of 1995. But Mr. Pawar is now playing that role. This government really works the way he wants it to work. And it's not a coincidence that the Home Minister belongs to his party, the Finance Minister belongs to his party. So he's got all the meaty portfolios. He's got Uddhav Thackeray to hold the can and weather the storm, so to speak. And he's kept a channel open to the BJP. There were rumors of his meeting Mr. Amit Shah in Ahmedabad last week over a dinner. Neither side has denied that. They've let that rumor gather momentum. And Mr. Shah, I believe, has gone on record today to say that we will see what happens in Maharashtra after the 2nd of May. So I think the period of uncertainty isn't over yet. But the immediate crisis from the extortion may have blown off, because there is now an inquiry. The former commissioner went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court told him, this is not the place. If you have a problem, go to the High Court. So he is in the High Court. The High Court says, actually rapped him on the knuckles and said, why are you coming to us? You were the commissioner of police. If you knew this extortion was happening, you should have filed an FIR and conducted an investigation. So I'm not sure that story is going to trouble Mr. Thackeray immediately. But the period of uncertainty will continue. And that uncertainty and instability is exactly what the opposition wants in Maharashtra, so that nobody really gets comfortable. Not the Shiv Sena, not the NCP, and not the Congress. So they're doing, the BJP is doing what its mandate is, which is to play the role of the opposition. They're probably playing it a little too seriously, but they are. So the uncertainty and instability, I think, is going to continue.
Finally, you mentioned meeting some aging dons. Have you had any, you know, encounters, so to speak, with the ecosystem in your years of covering Mumbai?
Oh, yes, several. Ejaz Lakravala, who I mentioned earlier, his cousin used to be in this business. And while reporting for a story, and I reported on Bombay right through the 90s, when extortion was the only story that came out of Bombay other than Shiv Sena. And I found myself in his office in near Bandra Khar, and he would, of course, not come on record about anything at all. And when I went into his office, I was alone, and he said, look, I'm going to close everything so that nobody hears us, and you will only leave this office when I am ready to let you go. I thought a shiver ran at that point, but I think I managed to keep my cool. We finished the interview in, I think, in about half an hour, 40 minutes, but it was well over 3 hours when I left his office. That's one. The other one is, of course, when I was covering a story on dance bars, and dance bars were a huge part of the extortion economy structure. And I ran into a don who then went to the usual route of Dubai and Karachi and all of that. And he said, you know, you people, acha, aap India today se hain, and you people put us, of course, in Hindi, you people put us on the cover as if we are, you know, we are the villains of this city. But hamare bagair to Bombay thap ho jayegi, Bombay chalegi hi nahi. Make sure you put this quote into your next story. So I said, are you sure you want to be quoted on this story? On this line, he said, yes, I will rattle off names to you of people who are in power today and people who met me yesterday, and you can print even those names. And he gave me five names, three of which were in the government at that point. And I said, of course, if we went with all of that on record, we would have probably had defamation cases on us, and we did not. And then there was another time when, after the 1993 blasts, I remember when we were covering those trails, the trail initially led to Kashmir militants, and then, of course, to the Memons and Tiger Memon and the travel agency and all of that. And RDX, how exactly was RDX smuggled into Bombay? And it was through the extortion route. And the customs officials were involved at that point. So were the cops at the landing jetties. And when I was trying to track down the RDX route, I happened to get into the crosshairs of the gang that had facilitated that. And I went along with this person who said, I'll actually show you where the rest of the RDX is stored. And I thought I would have a great story on hand. So my photographer colleague and I went into this place, and we were shooting, and then we realized that this may not be RDX, and we've probably been led into, of course, this was the basement of a very, very old building in the old part of Bombay, old city of Bombay, and there was no RDX stored there, of course. This person had managed to lock us up for the rest of the day until he got a clearance from the Don that we weren't going to go and squeal and he can allow us out. But through the day that we were locked up in this basement, I must say they took very good care of us. They asked us if we wanted biryani and if we wanted thumbs up and if we wanted this and that. And all they said was, please let us go. And they wouldn't. Frankly, at that point, I did not know how it was going to end. But it ended well for me, I guess. So
scary,
you know,
scary stuff. and you must write a book on this. Great, insightful as usual. Unlike Ejaz Lakdawala, I'm going to let you go because we're running out of time. Thanks, Smriti. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Sunit.
You have been listening to The Signal and the Noise. We would love to hear from you. Reach out to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram on @HTSmartcast.
Or you can also reach out to us personally at Sunit Arora
and @AJAxiom. To listen to more such interesting podcasts, do log on to htsmartcast.com.
We'll be back next week with a new story, another fresh voice, or a unique take on the world.
Do stay well until then and keep supporting good journalism.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.